This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It isn't often that HIV researchers declare a breakthrough. In 2012, they thought they had one, an infant known as the Mississippi Baby, born with HIV and treated at birth. The baby seemed to have kicked the virus after 2 years with no medication. It seemed too good to be true, and it was. Last year, the baby's doctors reported the infection was back. But this week, AIDS researchers are buzzing over a new patient, born with the virus and off the meds for 12 years, and she's still HIV-free. Is it deja vu all over again? Here to talk about it and other selected short subjects in science is Virginia Hughes, science editor at BuzzFeed News. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Good to be back.
Tell us about this new case. Is it deja vu all over again?
Yeah, well, we'll see. So far, she's still in remission. So this is an 18-year-old girl in France who, as you said, has been in remission for 12 years. So it's definitely the longest ever of somebody who was born infected with the virus. She has a pretty unusual case history. So she was born with HIV, and then she was given intensive therapy from birth until about 6 weeks old. Then she had a short period off, and then again from about 3 months to 6 years. And then when she was six, apparently her parents decided that they wanted to take her off the drugs. And so they did. And a year later, they went back to the doctors, and that's when the doctors first recorded that she didn't have any detectable virus in her blood. And it's been that way ever since. So
when do you ever get cured, quote unquote?
Yeah. Well, so they're technically not using the word cure in this case because even though there's no detectable viral load, apparently there are other biological signatures in her blood that indicate that the presence of the virus. So they're pretty careful not to use the word cure, but she's effectively cured. She's not symptomatic. And
that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. And there's another story. If you're a Benji person like myself, this one actually scares you. It's this one about as people who are driving now listening to the show, you've got a story about a pretty scary car hack. For all the cars now are, right, they have computers in them.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. You get in the car now. Most new cars, there's cell service and Bluetooth and Wi-Fi. This is an absolutely terrifying story from Wired magazine this week. Where this journalist, Andy Greenberg, gets in his Jeep and he starts driving 70 miles an hour down the highway. And all of a sudden, his car starts doing crazy things that he's not telling it to do. So the windshield wipers go on, the air conditioning starts blasting, the radio goes on, and then, most frightening, the accelerator stops working and his car sort of is crawling along on the highway. And so this is all happening, it turns out, because he's agreed to be a guinea pig for these two computer programmers who have wirelessly hacked into his car's computer system.
Just to show that it can be done.
To show that it can be done, yeah. And so they're giving a talk about how they did it, or they're not going to say exactly how they did it, but they're giving a talk about it next month. And as of today, I heard Chrysler. So the technique they did was mostly for Chrysler vehicles.
I think it was a Jeep, or was it a Jeep?
It was a Jeep Grand Cherokee, I think.
Right.
So today, I just heard that Chrysler has done a voluntary recall of 1.4 million vehicles that has this basically Wi-Fi technology in it, saying to people, you need to, there's a software patch that you can download for your vehicle.
You stick it on a thumb drive and you put it in a USB port somewhere in the car?
Yeah, I assume you have to take it into the shop. It's pretty scary. And
yeah.
I think people have been talking about this for many years, but this is sort of the first proof of principle. And there's a new piece of legislation that was introduced this week that would make any car sold in the U.S. Have to have some protections against hackers.
Yeah, especially since everybody's talking about self-driving cars, right?
Yeah.
This is a direct link to that idea.
And so
they haven't told anybody how they did it?
That's right. They had apparently been sharing their results with Chrysler for the last 6 or 9 months or something. So they're trying to raise awareness about this.
I'll bet. Next, you've got a story of a medical study that, how shall we say, wasn't all it was cracked up to be?
Yeah. So this is about a slew of studies and commentaries that came out this week on deworming pills, which I didn't know this, but they're actually one of the most commonly used medical treatments in the world. They're these really, really cheap, 2 cents each, pills that treat gut parasites, which is something that children, millions of children all over the world are infected with. So about a decade ago, there was a big clinical trial in Kenya, and it showed that if you treat not only infected kids, but all kids in a school with these deworming pills, you see all kinds of benefits in their in school and in their health. And not only that, but you see the benefits in neighboring schools that weren't treated. So this led to sort of a deworm everybody policy. Mm-hmm. But this week, two new studies reanalyzed the data from that trial and found a whole lot of errors. There were big holes in the data set, and 11 different findings that were supposedly came out of the trial turned out to be wrong. But the interesting part is that the only reason this came to light is because the researchers involved in the original trial were, you know, honest and gracious enough to share their data from that original trial, which almost never happens. That kind of thing is vanishingly rare. There was a recent study that looked at thousands and thousands of medical trials and found that only 37 had ever been reanalyzed. And of those 37, only 5 had been reanalyzed by independent researchers. Wow. And one third of them, the reanalysis called the original findings into question, changed the take-home message of the trial. So it's really scary to think about. In this case, there's no fraud, there's no misconduct. Everybody's, you know, but a lot of these trials are done by pharmaceutical companies who have business interests and don't necessarily want to publish negative results.
Yeah, it's tough to get the negative results. Yeah, they don't have to publish them. And the last story, you've got a quirky one about a device that seems a little too good to be true, the Therapic.
Yeah, so we're in the summertime now, and everybody's getting mosquito bites. This is a device that looks something like a TV remote control, and it has a big button on it. And what you do is you set it on your bug bite, and you press the button, and it heats up the end to a very high temperature. And it supposedly gets rid of your itch from the bug bite.
It does.
Well, the research or the people behind its makers claim that when you heat up venom for most insects, it denatures it, which a bunch of insect experts have called into question. They say, no, that's not it. What's happening is when you heat up your arm, you're distracted by the pain of the heat, so you can't feel the itch anymore. But either way, it seems to work. The folks at Gizmodo raved about it. They said it was wonderful.
Well, at least we know there's a 30% placebo rate on anything.
So there
there's
going to
be some people, you know, and then the others are going to say, I spent, what, $13 for this thing?
$13, yeah.
I'm not going to ever admit that I got took on this thing. So, of course, it works. Thank you very much, Virginia.
Sure, thanks.
We'll see you next time. Virginia Hughes is science editor at BuzzFeed News here in New York. Next up, it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Ah, yes. On Monday, Russian billionaire Yuri Milner announced he'll be doling out over $100 million over the next 10 years to fund Breakthrough Listen. That's an effort to find intelligent alien life. Using telescopes in places like West Virginia and Australia, scientists will scan the skies in search of ET. But so what happens if you find intelligent life? Do we say, sup? Join me now to talk about the pros and cons of communication with potential alien life is Seth Shostak, senior astronomer and director of the Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks very much, Ira.
This is a good thing.
It is a good thing. Obviously, this is the biggest infusion of money for SETI since the NASA SETI program was canceled more than two decades ago. So there's that. But the other good thing is that they're going to spend some time studying what kind of messages would you want to send to putative extraterrestrials if you decide to send something.
Now, we've had messages on various space probes out there. Carl Sagan stuck a few on, you know, some of the probes that went up.
Yeah, we have. And those are all, if you will, greeting cards, because they're very short. I mean, they're a few thousand bits, if you will. I mean, you wouldn't be happy with that if your cell phone camera didn't have more pixels, more information than those messages. But those, in any case, are on spacecraft. And spacecraft will take millions of years to get anywhere interesting.
So we're trying to figure out what to say. Are we trying to figure out where to send it?
Well, that's always the question. If you pick up a signal, of course, it's very obvious where to send it. You just, you know, reply blind right. aware of the signals coming from. Short of that, you just have to guess which of the nearby stars are likely to have a planet or known to have a planet that could be habitable, and you might choose them on that mm-hmm. basis.
So what could be the bad news about this?
The bad news is this. Some people think that if you broadcast to the aliens, no matter what you say, you've betrayed our position. And if they're hostile, and you never know, but, you know, maybe 1% of them are hostile, they might launch their interstellar battle wagons and, you know, incinerate the Earth, and you would be really disappointed if that were the result of your initiative. So that's the potential downside. A lot of people think that, in fact, broadcasting into space sounds neat, not a good idea.
Well, you know, we've been sending them I Love Lucy for 60 years now, right? Don't we have leakage out of the Earth of radio, TV signals?
Well, absolutely, Ira. That's why I don't find these arguments very compelling, because it's very easy to demonstrate that any society that has the capability to threaten the Earth from hundreds, maybe thousands of light years away, any such mm-hmm. society has very much bigger antennas than we do, and they could pick up, you know, our airport radars. And obviously, we don't want to shut down our airport radars because we're afraid of or paranoid about some possible attack from space.
So what should we do? What kind of signals should we send?
Well, I have to give you my personal opinion. A lot of people have thought about this. A lot of people have discussed it. They want to know, should we tell the aliens about our bad side, environmental degradation, war, all that stuff, or not? Just send them poetry, whatever. In my opinion, I take a lesson from what happened almost 200 years ago when we deciphered the hieroglyphics. We were able to do that because there was a lot of material. I would send the internet. Just send it all, and they'll be able to figure out a lot of it.
A lot of porn going out into space.
Yes, indeed. I don't think it'll offend them.
All right, Seth. That's an interesting idea. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
Seth Shostak is a senior astronomer and director of the Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about building, buying, flying your very own drone. Would you like to do that? Have you thought about it? I actually got to fly my own. Well, I borrowed a drone from my next guest who will be here to talk about it this week. It was a lot of fun. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last week, in a test run, the FAA successfully delivered medical supplies to a rural Virginia clinic. They did it by using a drone. The 6-propellered aircraft flew 10 pounds of supplies over 35 miles away. The FAA and companies like Amazon are battling it out over developing drone technology, but you don't have to wait for them. You backyard hobbyists have, you know, we've been tinkering with drones for years. From pocket-sized flyers that can zip through your house to quadcopters equipped with cameras to snap the perfect droney. There's even professional drone racing circuits. They're not your dad's remote-controlled airplane, as I found out and flew my first drone this week with my guest, Steve Cohen, is president of the New York and New Jersey chapter of the Drone Network User Group. He's also a technology specialist with Bergen County Technical Schools. And if you have a yen to pilot your own drone, you want to see what the fuss is all about, he's here to give us the ABCs of droning right here in our studios in CUNY. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. I'm really happy to be here.
That was a lot of fun, flying that drone around my office this week.
I could tell.
Well, what's the difference between a drone that, like, kind I flew? What was the name of the kind of drone?
The drone that that you fly was called the DJI Phantom 3.
Phantom 3. Well, what's the difference between that and just an RC helicopter?
RC helicopter is, just in terms of skill level, is much more difficult to fly. If you were to imagine balancing a ball bearing on a cafeteria tray, That's the kind of hand-eye muscle memory coordination that a regular RC helicopter requires. Whereas a multi-copter or a quad or a drone, it's kind of interchangeable at this point. Is much easier. Has built-in stabilization algorithms.
Yeah, this was rock solid.
It
took my hands off the controls. It just hovered.
Yep.
Right there. And let me invite my listeners. If you'd like to ask questions about, do we call it droning? What do we call it?
We're in this funny place where the word drone. We're called the Drone User Group Network. I am the president of the New York City, New Jersey chapter, but I also lead the global group as well. I just want to put that out there. But the term is kind of it's kind of a colloquialism at this point. I mean, I prefer to think of them as flying robots. Hmm. I think that the technology is such that drone has a kind of negative connotation, but we call ourselves the Drone User Group Network to start the conversation.
Yeah, there's no weaponry on these.
Exactly.
844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at SciFry if you have any questions about drones. What's the best way to get started in the hobby?
Well, I think that not unlike what we did this week, buying something that's kind of entry level, off the shelf, what's termed ready to fly, or you're going to experience a lot of acronyms. So RTF is an acronym meaning ready to fly. You could also possibly purchase something that is not nearly as complex with cameras and practice indoors, something like a Blade Nano QX. It's a little 180 or not even 100 millimeter sized. It has all the stability control and rock solid steadiness that you experienced.
Wait a bit, what about, and you go through the malls, you see these drones flying around. Mm-hmm. Those good starter drones?
I'm leery of recommending them only because they don't survive the impact of your mistakes very well. Yeah.
Are you saying spend a few bucks more and get a better one? It'll be a better experience instead of turning you off right at the beginning?
Right. I mean, there's a couple of ways to approach it. I think that it's probably a good idea to spend a little more money and have a better experience, like you say. There's also some wonderful simulation programs that you can purchase or use online to get a handle on the orientation challenges, recognizing the aircraft's position in the air.
You know, there are stories of drones just flying away from people. Mm-hmm. They lose control. That must be a major problem with newbies.
I think that it is a problem. Oftentimes, it's just user error. The drones that you're talking about that fly away rely on GPS coordination and GPS signal lock to maintain their position. And if they're launched without that being locked in, it can cause a flyaway, as it's called. Yes.
You're the head of a couple of groups, one an international group. Mm-hmm. If people want to get involved with your group or learn more, how should they get involved?
The New York City, New Jersey chapter has a meetup page. meetup.com/NYCDUG. We do also have a global network called Drone User Group Network.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of geeks listening to our show. We love that. We call them Benjis. We rather try to like Benjamin Franklin.
I see.
You built your own. You showed me your drone, but yes. You started out building your own drone.
I did.
Is that possible?
Sure, it's absolutely possible, and it's oftentimes what happens once people get obsessed with the technology, like you did this week. I can see
you can tell. Huh?
Yes. When I started using the technology, there was no such thing as a ready-to-fly model, and I did then, let the Google be my helper and searched out how to actually construct these things. And it's a tremendous education. It's quite a learning curve in many cases, but it's also a great teaching opportunity. It's a great way for parents and children to play together with science. Mm-hmm. And it's a great lure for my high school and college students as well.
Well, let's talk about teaching. Do you teach the proper way to use the drone?
Oh, absolutely.
Because, there was a story this week about firefighters.
Yes.
Getting in the way of trying to put out some fires.
Right. That's the whole community really, really frowns upon that. If you're not invited on scene or if you haven't asked permission and gained it, you really shouldn't be doing that. And yes, absolutely. Our goals in terms of teaching our students and in terms of the group itself is to really champion the positive use and the safe use, in the world and, being safe and sane.
I have a question here from a tweet that came in from Mrs. Frizzle. Mrs. Frizzle?
Mrs. Frizzle, that's a magic school bus,
yes.
I think, right?
Yes. And she wants to know, Ms. Frizzle, what drones do you recommend for middle school robotics club? Are they buildable?
They are buildable. There are kits that are available through DJI. There's a kit called the Flame Wheel 450. That's a very economical frame. I think the frame set itself is maybe $35. Mm-hmm. You can purchase some motors from Hobby King or another, you know, similar retailer, and you could probably build something. Might not have the full telemetry features. You could probably do something with GPS for around $300. Mm.
I want to bring on the another guest who's going to talk about the first national drone racing championship.
Yes.
That was held, and it was held last week at California, at the California State Fair. Mm-hmm. Try to imagine Star Wars pod racing on a small scale.
Mm-hmm.
And there were time trials like any race, a few crashes, and I'd like to bring on someone who has built and raced her own drone in that championship. Zoe Stumbaugh is a drone racer and is pilot for Team Multirotor Superstore. She's based out in Santa Cruz. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, tell us about the race. What's it like?
Oh, wow, that race was incredible.
What is it? Do you actually have a camera that you're looking through as if you're sitting in the drone?
Yeah, so it's called first-person view. You have a camera on your aircraft that sends a live video signal back to your goggles that you then pilot the aircraft from.
Hmm. And so how many drones are in the race?
This race, we had 100 different participants. So it was quite amazing. It took several hours just to get everyone through the race.
Wow.
Because we could only fly 8 pilots at a time. So it was quite the event to have 100 pilots racing at one time.
Is it more like an oval car race, or do you go through obstacles and things?
It's definitely obstacle based. We have a course set up, at least we had a course set up with different flags and air gates that you fly under and through, and something that we call the obelisk, which is this giant monstrosity of a start gate that you fly through that has a timing system on it that records everybody's laps.
Wow. And how fast do the drones go?
With that course, we got up to about 50 miles an hour, although a lot of our drones will go as fast as 70 miles an hour or even faster if we're allowed.
What do you mean if you're allowed?
The AMA has a requirement that we keep our FPV aircraft under 70 miles an hour, so it's kind of a safety regulation.
Mm-hmm. But you could build one, I'll bet, because I know you're a tinkerer.
I have built one. I've actually flown above that speed limit a couple times, but only in a giant open field with nobody around.
There you go. How did you get started in this? Zoe, you there? Oh, we may have... maybe she's... Her drone has left.
I'm willing to bet that she's built more than one. I would venture a guess.
Let me see if I can get some calls in until we can see if we can get her back. Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Let's go to David in Bethesda. Hi, David.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say I loved Newton's apple way back in the day.
Oh, thank you.
I got a question about software for controlling my drone. I wonder if you guys know of a software that's available that would allow me to program, say, an orbit, or like around a ball field, and also maybe I would ideally like to control a camera and be able to have it camera lock on, say, like the pitcher's mound in a ball field, and have the software through whatever means, GPS or whatever, maintain that slow orbit around the ball field.
David, you sound like a serious drone-y or whatever we call them. thanks for calling. Let me get an answer, Steve. Drone pilot.
David, that's a great question. There's actually there's software that's available on certain platforms and third-party systems that will enable you to do that right now. There's a product called the 3DR Solo that has those kind of features built in, a follow me mode where you would through an iPhone or a smart tablet interface basically select the point, in your case the pitcher's mound, and then basically say go and it would lock onto that position, or again select a position and tell it to go into an orbit mode. So those kinds of softwares exist, but right now they are very much platform proprietary.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Isaiah in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey guys, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I heard the guest say that, you know, they don't like to use the term drone because, you know, most Americans, when they think of drones, they think of weaponized drones that we use throughout the Middle East. But I recently saw a video, I think it was 2 days ago on YouTube, where somebody had fashioned to a quadcopter a Glock pistol and was actually using the drone as a personal homemade weaponized drone.
Steve, you know about this.
I do know about this, and yeah, none of us are particularly pleased about it in the community. You know, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And this is really the kind of activity that all of us who spend a lot of time and have sweated and toiled and spent lots of money and have our hearts and souls in this, we really frown upon that kind of activity.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. I'm talking with Steve Cohen, president of the New York, New Jersey chapter of the Drone Network Users Group, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Yeah, I imagine people, you know, are worried.
Oh,
about
sure.
Weaponizing just hobby drones.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's something of a legitimate fear in some ways. But you know, steak knives are dangerous too, and nobody's getting pre-cut you know, steaks at the restaurant because of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're in a stage of the technology where. You know, I imagine the buggy whip makers were pretty upset when the automobile came out.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of liken it to that.
Let's go to who we got. Oh, let's. Oops. Oh, Chuck. Hey, Chuck in Coldwater, Michigan. Hi, Chuck.
Oh, how are you doing today?
Hey there.
I have a question about the drone racing, and I was actually watching. There was some broadcast of some of that race, and it's just amazing. But I'm wondering what it might cost for one of those drones and the virtual goggles to control it.
Well, that's a really good question, Chuck. I mean, there's a lot of different sort of levels of equipment that you can invest in. You're probably looking at a good $1,000 investment to get something that you'll be satisfied with. The goggles, a decent pair will set you back to $250 or $300, and then the transmitter and receiver. Well, actually, the goggles usually have a receiver built in, but there's a transmitter end and a specific camera that you need that is low resolution but low latency, meaning there's no delay. And then the aircraft itself, which I mean, you're looking at least $400 for the aircraft
mm-hmm.
alone.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones again to Dennis in Danbury, Connecticut. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ira. How are you today?
Hey there.
I got a question that's a little bit off the recreational usage of drones, but I've been noticing on the internet that they talk about jobs in the future that will be high in demand, and they've referred a lot to drone pilots, that they'll be looking for people, companies like Amazon and so forth will be looking for people to do that. My question was, is there any more companies that you guys might know about that might be interested in something like that? And what is your opinion with regards to that demand? I mean, what training what training might be involved?
Yeah, is there a whole new business in training people?
There certainly is.
To fly these drones.
Absolutely.
If you're going to get commercialized.
Yes. What we're working with Bergen County Technical Schools and with Bergen Community College in Paramus is actually developing a flight training center. For professional development, and ultimately for a full-time curriculum. We have an aviation school there already. But in terms of the question directly, this is going to be a field that promises to, you know, I've heard numbers of $80 billion, $120 billion over the next decade. What we're really talking about is unmanned autonomous systems. So right now, you know, we talk about the Internet of Things and I mean, if you have a robotic vacuum cleaner, if you have the Roomba, you're already using an autonomous, unmanned autonomous system to vacuum mm-hmm. your floor. So project those devices to snow removal or to roofing or to ditch digging. Really, pardon me, anything that is dirty, dangerous, or boring.
Yeah.
Is going to be the milieu of the drone.
Yeah.
It's a robot.
Yeah. I got about a minute left, but people have been asking, how do you check out to see if you live near a military base or mm-hmm. an airport to know whether you're going to be violating anybody's airspace?
That's the best question today. There's a couple of different ways. You can locate your local Academy of Model Aeronautics chapter by going online, and that information would be available to you. You can also look at the FAA website and check out their aircraft or airline sectional maps to see. But basically, we want to stay away 3 miles from any major airport.
All right, Steve, thank you very much. Steve Cohen, president of the New York, New Jersey chapter of the Drone Network Users Group, also a technology specialist with Bergen County Technical Schools. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to see how studying dolphins might give us a clue to our own health, diabetes. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, we know that diabetes affects about 9% of the population, according to the CDC, but I didn't realize this until I started researching the story this week. But diabetes is not just a human disease, and specifically dolphins, you know, Flipper, can develop a metabolic syndrome that is similar to pre-diabetes in humans. But unlike humans, dolphins can switch in and out of this state and never develop full-blown diabetes. Researchers looked at the diets of wild and captive dolphins for clues to that metabolic syndrome, and the results were published in the journal PLOS One. Let me introduce my guest, Stephanie Van Watson, an author on that paper and director of the Translational Medicine and Research at National Marine Mammal Foundation in San Diego. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you're welcome. It's nice to have you. Let's talk about how does this metabolic syndrome work in dolphins? They go in and out?
Well, we're learning a lot about metabolic syndrome now. And like you had said to your audience, that dolphins, just like people, can get this metabolic syndrome called prediabetes. Now, you can't really look at a person or dolphin and say that they have prediabetes or metabolic syndrome by looking at them. This involves changes in the blood, like higher insulin, higher triglycerides, that we see in these people. And like you had said, with regard to metabolic syndrome, this is affecting one in every three adults in the United States and puts people at a greater risk of type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and stroke.
Now, I'm sorry, keep going.
Oh, so there are studies out there, really interesting large-scale human studies, showing that people who eat a lot of fish, have a lot of fish in their diet, have a lower risk of developing metabolic syndrome. And people who, there are other studies who show that people who eat a lot of fish have no effect, and yet others, Ira, that say that they have an increased risk of getting metabolic syndrome. And so that got us thinking that maybe a fish is not a fish. And since we work and care for dolphins, we wanted to take a look at specific nutrients in fish that might unlock the secret of what it is in fish that might protect against this disease state.
So you found that there was a certain kind of fat that the fish eat, the dolphins eat, not the fish, that controls their metabolic state?
We did. How cool is that? And
wow.
on top of that, not only is it a fat, it's a saturated fat. And so it's found in very low levels, but it's called heptadecanoic acid, or C17 I'll pronounce it that way.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. And we found that dolphins that have higher levels of C17 in their blood had lower, healthier insulin levels. And then we gave six dolphins a modified diet with higher C17. And within 6 months, we saw their triglyceride and insulin levels go down.
Wow, that's just against what we hear about, you know, eating saturated fat.
It is.
So this actually got their insulin levels down. And can you make that jump from a dolphin to a person?
Well, there are some important common ground for dolphins and people that are not readily apparent. We did not recreate the evolutionary table and show that dolphins and people are close together. But people and dolphins have large brains, and we both need to have lots of readily available glucose to feed those brains. And we also have red blood cells that can rapidly transport glucose. This trait was once believed to be unique to primates. And they looked at all other animals, and they found the same thing in cetaceans, including dolphins.
And now there's a quote from your news release that says that we hypothesize that the widespread movement away from whole fat dairy products in human populations may have created unanticipated C17 acid deficiencies.
That's right. And if you go to Wikipedia today, C17 has four humble lines. So it hasn't been well studied, but C17 is known to be present in trace amounts in dairy fat. Mm-hmm. And so obviously this is not the relevant part for the dolphins because they're getting it through their fish. But for us, as we've moved more and more toward non-fat dairy products, could that be lowering our C17? And in fact, we went to the grocery store, pulled some products off the shelf, and we tested a bunch of different dairy products for C17. Non-fat milk had no levels, and then it increased until we got to Glorious Butter. Clearly, I'm biased. That had 6 times higher levels of C17 compared to even whole fat.
So you're not telling everybody to just spoon down butter at this point.
Oh, no. You're a marine mammal, but yeah.
But you are going to test it on kids here.
We are. Our next steps are to collaborate with children's hospitals. And because children have traditionally had high fat, you know, we're used to saying kids drink your milk. And that may have been changing over the past few years because of diabetes. And so we want to work with children's hospitals to see if children with metabolic syndrome, a disease called fatty liver disease, present in one in every mm-hmm. 10 children, to see if maybe they're at increased risk because, in fact, kids have moved to non-fat milk as well.
Why is it that the dolphins have this ability or desire this ability to be able to control their insulin levels?
Well, dolphins have a fantastic history, and they were originally land animals who probably ate a lot of grains and carbohydrates. They basically were large-brained camels on land, and they decided about 50 million years ago to go back into the ocean, or to go into the ocean, mm-hmm. and they switched from a high-carb to high-protein diet, and so they weren't getting a lot of glucose sugars in their diet. So that we think they developed this ability to switch in and out to help easily be able to have their own bodies make the glucose it needs.
Do they get type 1 diabetes too, like humans might have?
It's a great question. They don't get what the disease state that we know is type 1 diabetes, but interestingly, studies that were done long ago by the father of marine mammal medicine, Dr. Sam Ridgway, in the 60s, showed that when dolphins were provided glucose or sugar water, they had a very high sustained high sugar, blood sugar, and no insulin response, looking just like a person with type 1 diabetes.
Wow. How surprised were you when you found this out about the dolphins?
Surprised, very surprised, and pleasantly surprised. I'm a fan of food with C17 in it. So,
and you say it's in butter because everybody's going to want to know, where do I get, you know, where can I stock up on C17? And you say it's right there in butter.
It's in butter, but yeah, that's right. And in some fish types and in rye. And I think the research is early. We're hoping that by getting this research out, that a broader research community will look at what foods have it. And for us, it's wonderful, as working in dolphin health, that this may be a very easy way to be able to ensure that dolphins are getting the optimal diet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we love our dolphins.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And it's an interesting study. Well, when you know more, and you know, welcome. You're welcome to come back.
Great. Thanks, Ira. We'll take you up on that.
We will. Stephanie Van Watson is an author on that paper and director of translational medicine and research at the National Marine Mammal Foundation in San Diego. You know that infectious bacteria have a way of outsmarting us, right, all the time. So maybe it's time we stop trying to kill them and we pit them against each other instead. It's sort of a bacterial Hunger Games. That's right, a death match of cell against cell. Cells and bacterial colonies, they actually work together to stay alive and fend off their enemies, making them super-resistant antibiotics. But by understanding these partnerships, we might be able to turn the friendly bacteria against each other so that the odds may not ever be in their favor. The idea was explored in a study published in Nature this week with my guest, Gural Sowell. He's an author on the study and associate professor of molecular biology at the University of California, San Diego. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Now, I understand this involves not just, you know, your kind of bacteria that float around, but this is something called a biofilm. Tell us what a biofilm is.
A biofilm is actually, you can think of it as sort of a city for bacteria. It turns out that bacteria, even though they are unicellular organisms, technically speaking, which means they can survive on their own, just like people, they congregate and they live in very tightly packed communities, which we call biofilms.
And where can you find biofilms? Are they in nature or all around us?
Well, it turns out they're actually everywhere, meaning you can find them. You want to do an experiment yourself, you can probably touch your skin. You might have some biofilms there for sure. You have lots and lots of biofilms within your digestive system. Almost all the bacteria there are residing within such biofilms. And as you may know, we have approximately 10 times more bacterial cells in our bodies than we have human cells. So they're everywhere. And of course, we find them in the depths of the ocean and on top of the mountains. And they've been around for about 3.5 billion years.
So do they create these biofilms as a way of helping the colony survive?
So they basically naturally form these collectives, and it seems that, as you're suggesting, yes, that as a unit, as a collective, as a community, they are much stronger in terms of surviving attacks, chemical attacks, or if we throw antibiotics at them, than they would be if all the bacteria would be sort of just wandering around on their own.
So give us an idea of the structure, how it works, how the survival technique works.
So that was something that actually sort of just came out of our results. We were surprised to find that what appears to be happening is that when the biofilm forms, when this community forms, some cells find themselves on the interior of this community, like downtown, if you will, and some cells find themselves on the periphery. And just the very fact that some cells are basically in different locations within this community means that they are experiencing different types of environmental conditions. And they begin to communicate with each other by sharing or competing for metabolites.
Mm-hmm. And so one supplies the metabolite for the other?
That's right. So the cells on the periphery, the cells that are on the outer edge of this sort of medieval castle, if you want to think about it, they protect the cells on the interior because they're by their very being there on the outside, they form the first line of defense, if you will. But they also get first dips on all the food that's coming in from the outside because the food is also coming in from the outside. And the cells on the interior, in return, make a little molecule that the outer cells use for growth. And it's called ammonium. It's diffusible, which means it can get in and out of cells. And so the outer cells, as long as they get this, they grow and they're happy. But when they grow too much, they consume all the food, leaving none to be left for the cells on the interior. And when that happens, the cells on the interior stop making this ammonium gas molecule, which means that now the peripheral cells stop growing. When they stop growing, they stop consuming the food, and that can now slowly trickle in and allow the cells in the interior to be able to grow again and make this metabolite, and then allow the peripheral cells to grow, and round you go, and you find sort of beautiful oscillations.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Now, if you were to artificially supply the metabolite to the outer layer, it would grow nice and happy. It wouldn't need the inner cells anymore.
That's right. You make them independent, and since the bacteria have no brains, right, they're not doing this consciously. It's sort of something that emerges out of the complexity of the system. They would keep growing and growing, and by doing so, they would starve the interior cells that are the most protected and the most sheltered from attack. They would starve them to death, and that's where the Hunger Games comes in.
So does that mean then that if you give antibiotics, they would be more effective on this group of cells?
Yes, if we could turn the cells on each other by enhancing competition between them, by basically making the outer cells independent of the interior cells for their growth, they would grow, and thereby kill the interior cells. It's if like the Secret Service would eat all the food and the president would never get a chance to get a bite.
Now, you have found a way to genetically alter these exterior cells so that they make their own ammonium?
That's right. We allowed them to declare their independence by overexpressing an enzyme, which is a protein that allows these bacteria to then synthesize for themselves this molecule that they would otherwise depend on from the interior cells.
And so?
And by doing so, yes, they then keep growing and growing and growing, and then they kill the guys that are hard to reach for us. So they do the dirty job for us.
And you tested this out and it works.
Yeah, we tested it out. It works. We were surprised and happily surprised. Sometimes, you know, you need luck in science. And so we got a little bit lucky, and it seems like it's really working.
You know, people are made up of groups of cells cooperating with each other. Could something like this be happening other places inside of us?
I think so. I mean, just as a human society, we're actually not that sort of unfamiliar with this concept. We all live in a city,
right,
which means we cooperate. Different people have different sort of, there's division of labor. Different people do different things, right? We need the we need people to protect us, make food and things like that. But we all compete for each other for sort of resources at the same time. We all need water, electricity, food. And so we're used to the concept of both collaborating and competing with each other. And it's this sort of social interaction that seems to be happening in biofilms, even though the bacteria are clearly not, you know, lacking sort of, they're lacking a brain, right? They're not doing this in sort of a conscious way.
Well, so we'll wait for the major motion picture then, too.
Stay tuned. You'll be the first to see the trailer.
All right. Gaurav Sohail is an associate professor of molecular biology at the University of California in San Diego. Welcome. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
You're welcome. Before we go, one last thing. Romantic kissing, you know, those lip-to-lip passionate gestures? Turns out it's most likely a modern invention and is only present in less than half of the world's cultures. A study of 168 cultures published in the American Anthropologist found no evidence that the romantic sexual kiss is a human universal or even a near universal. Romantic kissing was evident in 100% of the cultures in the Mideast, but zero, nada, in Central America. What is remarkable in these findings, write the researchers, is that romantic sexual kissing appears to have appeared so late in human evolutionary history. Just a few decades ago, when the Mahinco Amazonia tribe observed Europeans kissing, their first reaction was one of disgust at such a gross behavior. While kissing may be a way to communicate intimacy in some societies, for quite a few, kissing is seen as unpleasant, unclean, or simply unusual. That's about all we have for today. Charles Berkowitz is our director, senior producer. Christopher Taliata, Alex Lim is our associate producer. SciArts producer Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin, our video producer. Production assistant Becky Fogel. Our intern is Ella Fetter. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman is our engineer. At the controls here at the studios of our production partners at the City University of New York. And as you probably heard about the superhero Ant-Man, but have you heard about the Saharan silver ant? Yeah, it's got a few powers of its own that it uses to beat the desert heat, including a thick coat of shiny silver hairs. And better yet, it's our picture of the week. You can check out the Saharan silver ant at our website at sciencefriday.com/silver ant. While you're there, you can email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Visit our webpage. And if you like us on Facebook. We're up there all week long. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.